All right, let's take our Bibles and we'll turn to James 4. That'll be our primary text. Of course, we'll look at Proverbs as well, but James will be our main text. So James chapter 4 tonight, two particular topics. This being part 3 of our look at the wisdom of James and Proverbs, this is part 3 if you're taking notes. And the two subjects at hand tonight will be humility and boasting about the future. So not just simply boasting, but boasting about the future in particular. So you'll want to get your handouts out. Well, you don't have to, but I will briefly reference it. And then we'll look at the two things. Just real quick, because I know I'll end up forgetting this. So if you're interested, since I know this isn't a James study like I would normally do, but these were put out today, the new devotions for Moody, and it's on James. So if you're interested in a devotion on James from Moody, this one is on James. And if you flip it over, there's another study. But anyway, if you're interested, there's several of them out there. If you want to take some, let me know. They're in the office. But should you be interested? All right. Before I give you the outline, I'm going to read you this quote. Anybody ever heard of Bob Jones? You know, the university and all that kind of stuff has a quote on wisdom. I've been using some different quotes, but this one from Bob Jones says, "Men may acquire knowledge, but wisdom is a gift direct from God." So looking at some different quotes, and that one by Mr. Jones himself. But tonight we're going to look at continuing our study. If you have the handout, this again is part 3. And what we're going to look at tonight is I'm going to do a little bit of a review of this, not really very much at this point since we've covered it twice. I'll touch on this real quickly, do a review of the first 4, and then we'll pick right up, which is going to be the 5th and 6th in the chart there. Grace for the humble. So James is going to speak about grace given in a greater way to those who are humble versus those who are prideful. And then we'll look at the corresponding verse there in Proverbs. And then we'll look about boasting about the future. If you want to read ahead, the plan is to cover 3. I know, take a deep breath. 3 in 1 next week. But those, a little bit more brief on one of them. But so what we're going to do tonight is look at a review of the handout, and then we'll cover the 5th and 6th on there, which is the first is humility being number 5 on the list, and then we'll see boasting about the future. So that'll be what we cover tonight, and then hopefully I've got it timed roughly, so there'll be some time for question and answers at the end. But at this time, I've already introduced where this originates from. So if you remember, I was doing a study years ago through James, and I ended up coming up with this chart because the references aren't just sort of illusions. When I say an illusion, it's a rough reference. These are very specific references on 9 topics that James teaches on that he either directly quotes or paraphrases from Solomon in the book of Proverbs. And we have covered the first 4. And I've quoted Wearsby twice now, so you know J. Vernon McGee, you know, get on the bus, the Bible bus. He says of James, the epistle of James has been called the Proverbs of the New Testament because it is full of practical wisdom for every day. And that's a good point there. But let's look at just briefly. I've covered the first 4. I won't go back over these in depth. We've looked at wisdom, anger, partiality, in other words, favoritism. And then we left off with speech. Wisdom, when we are lacking, where should we go? Well, we go to God. That's what James teaches right off from the beginning of James chapter 1. God is gracious in giving us where we lack in wisdom, direction, those sorts of things. And he is not going to scold us, or he will scold us. Now, of course, he will not. Of course not. So that's kind of what we've covered with wisdom. Then we looked at anger, of course. Primarily, it's dealing with sinful anger. I did compare righteous anger so there wasn't confusion, or at least not hopefully too much, against sinful anger. And my basic way of looking at it is righteous anger would be the idea of upholding the things of God. Sinful anger, of course, would typically not be doing that. Third was partiality and favoritism, doing or taking preference of one over the other. And Linda made the good point, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. It says in there, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So we should treat others as we want to be treated. That would be the idea there. So if a poor person or rich person comes in, it shouldn't really matter. They should be treated equal within the church. Okay. Even when the offering plate goes around. Ha ha. So good point on that last time. But then lastly, we looked at speech. The speech one is the one I think is interesting, the way he describes that, he meaning James. He uses the bit in the mouth of the horse and then the rudder with the boat, and both turn something that is larger than itself, and the mouth is the same way, in other words, with the tongue. But then he uses the illustration of fire with the tongue. Why is that? Well, because the tongue and fire both can start off small, but then cause great consequences. And in a sense, the tongue can bring what? Life or death. Death or life, depending on how you look at it. So we've covered those, and tonight we're going to look at everyone's favorite, which is humility, because we all like being humble, don't we? Well, if you don't like being humbled, you will be humbled, and so you might as well choose to be. But we're going to look at this tonight. Now, before we read, now we don't have any really long passages tonight, so I'm not sure. James, I think Gene's going to be depressed a little bit, but I think you should hold off for the second one because there's two verses versus one. So either way, but in all seriousness, before someone reads James 4:6. Which is what we're going to look at just in brief. Normally, obviously, if I was going through it like I normally do verse by verse, we would have covered the first five verses. But in short, James is speaking of things that a believer is to try to avoid. But he also indicates that we don't have to try to do it in our own strength. But in particular, when we fail or fall short, have you ever done that? Yeah. Well, what does God do? He gives a greater grace. In other words, he gives us even more grace. So it's a good hymn that we sang earlier because it does deal with grace. So someone read verses James 4, 6, so just one. So the idea here is that God will help, but he helps a particular type of or attitude of a person versus an unwillingness to another type of person. But someone read for me James 4, 6.
But he gives a greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble.
All right. So like I said, basically, if you were to read this first five verses, he's giving these, if you will, things to avoid, you might say. That's essentially what he's doing here. But as he goes into this, one of the things and the ways to look at this verse that Merritt just read is, so when we fall short, the idea is that God will give a greater grace. In other words, he gives more grace to us to help us out. So the idea is when we're struggling, maybe it's the old sin nature. Do you ever have the old nature, as we call it, sometimes pop up? Sure. It's not completely eradicated. Sometimes it's more subdued than others. Or said another way, you have a habit that popped up that's a sinful habit. The idea here is that God is going to give us grace, but it's a greater grace. In other words, he gives us grace to try to help us to do this. Now, what is grace? Now, we all use the grace is God's unmerited favor, right? All right, so that's fair enough. But I'm going to quote from Charles Ryrie's So Great Salvation, because I like this quote for grace, and I've used it before, but I prefer this one because I think it encapsulates several issues. But he says, Ryrie writes that grace is God's unmerited favor, which we know that, but it says, it is undeserved on the part of the recipient, it is unearned and unearnable. The idea is just that grace would be negated. In other words, it could no longer be grace if you somehow earned it. And so I like Ryrie's definition there because it's, of course, undeserved on our part, but you can't earn it on the front end, but you can't earn it on the back end. In other words, once we come to saving faith, it doesn't negate or null God's grace. That would basically remove the idea of grace. So God, if you read that verse there, it says he gives a greater grace. So God doesn't simply give us grace at the point of salvation. It's this idea of continually doing so, but in particular when we fail. Do we need God's grace every day? Well, of course. But what happens when we fail as a believer? Well, we really need it then. We need God to extend grace to us because we probably don't deserve it. Now, I'm going to give this example of this, and I'm going to use Peter. We all know that Peter, and this, I'm using this a little bit as a variation of a text, a proof text we're going to look at in a second. But Peter's problem was pride, wasn't it? In other words, in the denials and so forth, because he boasts what? Oh, Lord, I'll go to death for you. And then within just a short period of time, he denies not once, twice, but even three times. There was this little girl. And the point is, Peter's problem was pride, wasn't it? And you'll notice in a minute, we're going to see the whole thing hinges on pride versus humility. But Peter denied the Lord three times. We know that. And a lot of times we turn to John, which I understand I do. But I want us to look somewhere else just to try to illustrate this a little bit. It's Mark 16, verses 6 through 7. Because clearly, if you turn to John, the end, and John 21, Jesus is very gracious, merciful to restore Peter threefold, if you will. But this is just a variation. It's essentially doing the same thing, but just a different proof text, if you will. So the resurrection happens, meaning the morning of the resurrection, Mary Magdalene and etc. They go, they roll away the tomb. So again, Mark 16. And then upon entering into the empty tomb, they see this man, air quotes. I assume it's to be an angel, as I've always taken it to be, but story for another day, wearing a white robe. But notice in verse 6, and I'll just read it. And he, that meaning the angel, I would think of it, the young man, said, "Do not be amazed. You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who has been crucified. He has risen. He is not here. Behold, here is the place where they laid him." We're pretty familiar with that. But look at the rest of this verse. What does the angel say? "But go tell his disciples." But who does he single out? Has Peter been restored yet? Well, we don't have the scene yet that I was referring to. That's the one you typically go to. I do. John 21, how many times does he ask Peter, "Do you love me?" He does it three times. But what is here? Peter has, if you're not following this, Peter has boasted. His pride has been broken because he weeps at the rooster's crowing. But here, what does Jesus immediately want to do? Jesus is seeking Peter out. And he's going to give him some grace there. So I just point that out there is that God hasn't, the Lord Jesus hasn't disowned Peter. He even singles him out by name to bring him about here. So that's just the idea there. So Peter, of course, had broken pride. And what was it replaced with? Well, ultimately, humility. You really see that later in his life in 1 Peter. The main thing here is the Lord continues to extend his grace to us even when we fall short. And especially when we need it the most is when we fall short. In other words, whether it be a sin, whatever that case may be. In Peter's case, he really needed grace along with mercy and forgiveness and all of that. But in the passage we are looking at in James, that's just sort of an idea. John 21 is perfectly applicable as well. But if you notice in James's quote, he's quoting directly from something we're going to look at, which is Proverbs. So this is back in James 4. 6. So we're pretty good. God gives greater grace. So when we fall into sin or need help, he is more than gracious to give us the bountiful need of grace. But moving on, it says, God is opposed to someone, but gives to someone else. Grace is given towards a particular type of character in a person, and it's not given to another type. And the first is everyone's favorite, pride. Because everyone at some point probably gets pride. Now, don't get confused. I'm not suggesting that you would. It's okay to have pride in your work. Okay. That's not what we're talking about here. Okay. So don't get confused. That's not a problem. We should be take pride in what we do or whatever the case is. But in order to receive this greater grace, in order to do that, pride needs to be dealt with. What is pride? Well, this is our couple of technical definitions, but pride is an excessive, elevated sense of self-worth. That's a Greek lexicon definition. Pride is an excessive, elevated sense of self-worth. It is self-exalting in the place of God. In other words, that's just sort of the idea, is it is exalting itself to an improper place. That's what the idea of pride is. So don't think of it as being prideful in your house, taking care of it. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the idea of elevating our view of ourselves to something that's just not healthy, would be another way to say it. Now, there's a couple of examples I'm going to give you both, and then we're going to read just one of them. The first one is, and these are going to be different because I'll be honest with you, when I think of using examples of pride versus humility, I think of Nebuchadnezzar, but I'm not going to use those because I've used it before. I'm going to give you two. One is King Uzziah. That's U-Z-Z-I-A-H. That's one of the kings of Judah. That's 2 Chronicles 26:16. You can look at that one. I do want us to look at this next one because even arguably, you could easily make an argument that King Hezekiah was one of the greatest, if not greatest, outside of David, kings of Judah. I mean, this just would be an argument. But he also had the same problem at one time, and I'm going to read it, but it's 2 Chronicles 32:25. So King Uzziah, U-Z-Z-I-A-H, that's 2 Chronicles 26:16. But King Hezekiah, 2 Chronicles 32:25, and I'll read that one since I already have it. But the reason why I mention these is, again, these are somewhat different. I tend to go with Nebuchadnezzar because it's such a great illustration of breaking of pride, humility, and all that. But even the great Hezekiah, because he's oftentimes put in the same category as Josiah. I mean, he's just a great king. But in 2 Chronicles 32:25, it says, but Hezekiah gave no return for the benefit he received because his heart was proud. Even the great King Hezekiah was, of course, subject and fell into pridefulness. So what would that say? Could any of us fall into pridefulness? Yeah, we probably all do at different times. Over the span of a year, I'm sure somewhere along the way, we've been prideful about something. The question, though, is there an antidote to remove it or to keep it from happening? And the answer is yes, it's humility. And that's what James is saying. James is saying God gives grace to us anyway, but he gives greater grace to us when we need it. But James is saying if you're prideful, God's going to hold that, if you will, remedy back. So when I think of humility, I think of it as either an antidote for it, meaning it removes it, or it keeps you from having it. Does that make sense? So it works both ways. So James says that God, of course, withholds, we might say, he's opposed to prideful people, whether that's Nebuchadnezzar, Uzziah, Hezekiah, but yet he gives the greater grace to those who are humble. So when a person is humble, what do? You could say it six ways a Sunday. They recognize that they fall short of the glory of God. They have fallen short of God, whereas a prideful person exalts themselves. A humble person, in many ways, though, is one who has a right evaluation of themselves. I think sometimes, I don't know if you've ever known people, they sort of beat themselves up to try to be humble. That's not what the idea is. We are made in the image of God. We have great value. All of us have value, even Dave, right? All high value, right? No, but we all have this, we all have inherent value. All humans do. The problem is man tends to have too much of an elevation of himself. He has a proper view. That's the idea of humility. It's not beating yourself up saying, oh, I'm a load of garbage. That's not what God is wanting for us, okay? So the Lord there is, what would we say? I would say it this way. The Lord is for those who are humble and is against those who are prideful. And pride can block the Lord from extending grace because a prideful person is not going to seek him or even think they need him. more often than not. Let's look at, so if you notice there in James 6, 4, 6, there's a direct quote. Let's look at the direct quote, and then I'm going to explain something about a Greek New Testament. And but this is Proverbs. This is on your chart. This is a direct quote from Proverbs 3:34. And someone can read that, but before they do, if someone gets it, it's Proverbs 3:34. This is just a, almost left this out, but this same verse, Proverbs 3:35, is quoted by Peter in 1 Peter 5:5. So the same person whose pride was broken quotes along with James this direct quote, but the quote is slightly varied. Now, why would it be slightly varied? Critics of the Bible would say, oh, see, they've got an error in it. No. If you have translator notes or notes or study Bible, sometimes they'll say this verse comes from the LXX. And most people will be like, what is that? It's called the Septuagint, and it's a Greek Old Testament. Okay, we tend to think of the Old Testament as always in Hebrew, which it is primarily, but it was translated in Greek. So sometimes anytime you go from one language to the next, there's some slight variations at times. So the quotes in the New Testament tend to be from the Septuagint. So sometimes they're not a one-to-one to the Hebrew. Does that make sense? Okay. So don't ever fall prey to someone saying that the Bible has error. The Bible doesn't have error. We just sometimes struggle to understand. Does that make sense? It's different. Anyway, back to the text. Someone read 3:34 of Proverbs. It's the same basic idea, and he's just varying the, if you will, articulation of it. Someone read that for me.
Sure. Though he scoffs at the scoffer, yet he gives grace to the afflicted.
All right. So grace there is given to, in that case, the afflicted there. And of course, the idea there is, again, the idea of pride versus the humble. And so that direct quote in 1 Peter 5:5 and James 4:6 comes from the Septuagint. So there's a slight variation of the text. But let me read this and then we'll move on to boasting. And I just boasted about the future, so we're going to boast about it. In just a minute, we're going to go to boasting about the future. But let me read you this quote. It's by Thomas Constable, and he sums up this here with humility, pride, and then God extending his grace. He says, God opposes the proud, those who pursue their selfish pleasures, but he gives grace to the humble, those who put God's desires first in their lives. He gives grace, i.e. help, to withstand the onslaughts of the flesh within and the world without. The idea there at the end is God gives us help. And we need help, and we don't need it simply at the point of salvation, but all the way until glorification, if you will. But let's move on. So we've looked at wisdom, anger, partiality, speech, and humility, and God extending humility to, extending grace to the humble. But let's move on to this last one here. This one, I actually will tell you, this is actually one of my favorite illustrations he uses. It's James, that is. James has some teaching tendencies, if you haven't noticed. I told you last time to Jesus. He likes to illustrate something, so a lot of times he'll state something, and he'll use these beautiful illustrations and then apply it through the illustration. And this is the same case here. So we're going to read in just a second. This one's set aside for Jean because this is the longer reading. It's two verses, so hopefully she can handle it. So short, she'll probably just keep reading to the end of the chapter. But before you do it, this is the idea of boasting, but it sort of plays into the pride one a little bit. Because instead of what it's doing is it's boasting about the future, which reflects what? Well, it's going to, we'll see, reflect an attitude of, in a sense, self-reliance and this idea of I can act independent of God, which has an element of pride in it a little bit, I think, as well. But someone read, should we know who, 13 and 14.
Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away.
All right. So thank you for that. All right. So here is the subject, of course. This is the idea of boasting. Now, boasting, what does the word boasting mean? I figured we probably were pretty good on humility, but boasting, I'll give it to you. If you want to study the Greek word for some reason, it's K-A-U-C-H-E-M-A. So again, that's K-A-U-C-H-E-M-A. Kokamah. Sounds funny, doesn't it? Actually, that's a very hard one to pronounce. But less worried about the pronunciation, what does the Greek word mean? Well, this one is a little helpful here, because sometimes if you study a Greek word, it doesn't really elaborate on the text any, but this one does. It is technically means to give glory and to boast in a particular object, which is more often self. And that's true, isn't it? And when someone boasts, and this is what the idea here is, they're typically boasting in this object, meaning they're boasting in themselves. So again, it means to give glory. It gives the idea of giving glory to self. That would be what boasting is. And the boasting tends to be in a negative when you're the object of it is, of course, yourself. So it's the idea of boasting in self rather than who? We can boast in the Lord's okay, right? So you put those two together, what's the bad? Well, the bad would be when we boast in ourselves. But anyway, I told you that James, I always appreciate because he, in verse 13, illustrates this idea using this idea of a businessman or a merchant, we might say. If you notice when it was read, I think the way he weaves some of these illustrations is great. It reminds me of the way Jesus teaches. But notice in verse 13, he says, of course, it's an illustration. He says, today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there and engage in what? Business as some sort of merchant, perhaps, whatever the case is, with the desire to do what? Well, what everybody wants to do, make money, right? So the illustration is of a businessman, a merchant, whatever you might want to think of it as. So he's making plans and he's planning on traveling and he's got all these time things that he's including. He's going to make money. Now, of course, the question would be, is planning bad? And we would say no. But if you notice in the text, what does he leave out? Leaves out God. That's the illustration. So in other words, what James is saying is, if you were to plan for retirement or maybe you plan for whatever the case is that bad? No, God expects us to plan. There's nothing wrong with that. But if we leave God out of our plans, that's where we run ourselves into problems. So it's an interesting illustration. He says, in a sense, there's this merchant, there's this man. He says, I'm going to go to this city and I'm even going to say what I'm going to do for a year. Do you know what you're going to do tomorrow? Well, it depends on how you answer the question, right? And that's sort of the point. Okay. I kind of have in my mind what I'm going to do. But do I really know? No. Because something could come along. Something could happen. And I'm sure you've had that happen before, right? Whatever. You know, the phone call rings. You don't feel well. It could be any number of things. Water pipe burst, like at Jean's place, and the next thing you know, you got water running down the floor. The point is in the illustration, what? Notice verse 14. Yet, it gives the idea there of, look, you don't even know what your life's going to be like tomorrow, let alone plan a year from now. And again, it's not saying that planning is bad. That would be the extreme. We also want to make sure that we include God, because making plans is fine, but they need to include the Lord. One way I think of this is, let's say we have a business meeting at church, the annual business meeting, and we do all this planning for the new year and we forget to ask God. Is that good? No, it's terrible. It might be okay to have made plans, but if we forget to ask God, what do you think? What is the Spirit's leading? That's not the way a Christian or a church should function, is it? It's fine for us to think, well, we might like to do this, but what does the Lord have for us? And that's the idea, is something the Lord's will. Now, let's look at here the verse in Proverbs. So this is Proverbs 27 in verse 1. And so illustration, like I said, I always appreciate James's illustrations. That one's a really helpful one. But Proverbs 27 in verse 1. And you can see where this one's, I mean, it's not a direct quote, but the beginning of it is, and the verse is very similar. These are actually not just simply instructions, but they're warnings that are coupled with instructions. In other words, is the idea of warning somebody of something. So Proverbs 27, 1, and it sort of plays a little bit into the idea of pridefulness. All of this does a little bit. But notice what it says in Proverbs 27, 1. Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. It's almost the same idea, isn't it? I mean, it is the same idea, but it's almost verbatim. This would be a little bit more of an allusion, meaning it's not a direct quote, but it's pretty close. Now, in Proverbs, what Solomon largely deals with is, I hate to say, fools and wise people. How many of us want to be a fool? All right. I've had enough practice with that. How many of us want to be wise? Okay. Well, if we want to be wise, we follow the instructions of the Lord. Now, the idea here is that wise people are not what? They're not boasters and braggers. That plays back into pride and humility a little bit. A fool boasts about something even though they can't be certain about it. A wise person would, in a sense, say, well, I'll plan, I may do this, if what? If the Lord wills, those sorts of things there. So that's sort of the idea there. Read you this from the Moody Bible commentary. It says, only a fool, and you have to understand, when you first read that, make sure you know that the idea in Proverbs is essentially a fool versus a wise person. Only a fool will boast about tomorrow, since no one can know for certain even what today may bring forth. Since both the present and future are in God's hands, the wise makes plans in the fear of the Lord, humbly trusting his disposition of events. And that's the main point. What James and Solomon are saying is it's okay to make plans. Don't leave God out of those plans. But we also shouldn't be boasting too much, because we don't even know what we're going to do at 8 o'clock tonight, let alone a year from now. Does that make sense? Who does know the future? God. So we need to seek him. Two things, one per subject. First, pride can close, notice can, doesn't always, can close the door to God's grace, while humility opens the way for his help. And that's the main thing there. We need to be humble, go to God when we need help. We already know he's not going to scold us and reject us. And then two, wise living means humble dependence on the Lord for today, but also for tomorrow, because he's the only one who knows what's going to happen anyway.